This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Alex Dimitrios, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's good to be here, Germ.
We were just chatting now a moment ago why it is important to kind of revise narratives about China. And it's stupid that we have to say this, but I don't know about you, but I'm not getting any funding from Chinese interests. I'm just interested in what's true.
Absolutely. You know, that can take you down a lot of interesting paths. But yeah, I mean, to not be interested in the world's largest country and this amazing civilization that goes back thousands of years, where the past of humanity and the future are being shaped, you know, you shouldn't have to be a paid shill to want to look into it.
Well, why China, though? Why is China always in the crosshairs?
I think they've managed to, because of their geography and, you know, some of the philosophical underpinnings of the foundation of their civilization, they've just been this incredibly interesting place where, you know, they've been open to trade, but, and during the, you know, what's called the Century of Humiliation, you know, Britain pumped opium and Americans too. They pumped opium into the country, and a lot of Westerners got really rich doing that. But they never lost. I'm not sure, honestly. I'm not sure what it is specifically about China, but they've managed to right the ship. And the things we're going to talk about today are about some of the attacks that have befallen China, that they've, you know, bargains that were presented to them that they had to take, but they had a larger goal in mind and a larger, I think ultimately it's a pro-human underpinning of Confucianism, where there's something very positive and very compatible with Christianity, where there's this view of man that sees man as a creative force in the world, where instead of just being an animal or being a subject to you know, your betters or something like that. Like, I think there's just something very pro-human and creative about China and the Chinese civilization that has helped them endure.
It's a very old civilization too. So, I mean, it actually has a lot going for it.
Yeah. It's, there's so much history. You know, even one of the best books I've read about it, you know, sometimes you have to read your enemies, but Henry Kissinger's book about China, he didn't just, you know, so we're going to talk about Henry Kissinger in this interview, but he didn't just go into it saying, who cares about these people? This doesn't, you know, I don't need to know the history. I just need to enslave these people or take advantage of them. He had a very deep understanding of Chinese history. And that's what got him access to China, was that he studied their history. He deeply understood it. And even late in his life, he was still being honored in China as a great statesman, because he actually took the time to try to understand China. And, he probably understood it better than the vast majority of Westerners and Americans. And that's what made him dangerous.
All right. Just for context, what is the official story regarding the one-child policy?
So the official story is that humans are a virus on the planet, and China, you know, they started communism, and Mao was a madman. He was genocidal, and they were trying to modernize the country, and millions of people died. And in order to, once Mao was off the stage and he died, they needed to right the ship, and they needed to get their population problem under control. And because China has, you know, to this totalitarian government, they decided they wanted to restrict everyone's, you know, reproduction, because, you know, they're ultimately, you know, the prototype for the Davos elite. So that's, you know, that's the official narrative, is that they wanted to do it because humans are a virus on the planet. There's no solution to hunger. There's no solution to modernization. They just had to restrict the population by all means necessary. And it's just evidence of the totalitarian brutality that's going on in China.
Yeah, just for clarity, it didn't happen under Mao, though, although he gets a lot of blame, but it came a few years after he died, right?
Right. Yep, under Deng Xiaoping.
And funnily enough, Mao himself liked the idea of a large population.
Yeah, in the 1949, there's a quote from him in my piece about the one-child policy that came out October 2023. It leads off with this beautiful quote from Mao. He says, "It's a very good thing that China has a big population." He says, "Even if China's population multiplies many times, we are fully capable of finding a solution. Revolution plus production can solve the problem of feeding the population. Of all the things in the world, people are the most precious. All pessimistic views are utterly groundless." So that's a great statement. And, you know, this is not that, you know, right. This is right in that environment of, you know, so many eugenic programs and population programs that, you know, in the West that had the exact opposite outlook, just viewing man as an animal instead of as a precious, you know, people are precious. That's what he said.
Okay. So what happened?
So in the 50s, you know, he started to waver a little bit, but, you know, overall he started saying things like it'd be great if we could lower the birth rate a little bit. We need planned births. He started saying some things like that to maybe he just, you know, was wavering a little bit. But then he later went back and said that a large population would be better, that they can manage even more people than they had. And, you know, keeping in mind too, that the technology of the time, the Green Revolution, which is, you know, the massive, growing of the amount of food that you can grow to basically make famines a thing of the past. The Green Revolution had not happened yet. So they didn't really have the technology yet to guarantee that they could feed everybody. And that's why in the early 60s, there started to be famines in China because they were trying to grow and expand the country and revolutionize the production. So they did have, and they got hit with famines and people did die. So then, you know, in the 60s, that all happened. And then by the early 70s, you started to see just in the West, this pushback against the massive expansion of technology. So like the Green Revolution was going on in India. We started to get all this technology where we could guarantee that more food could be grown. And then all of a sudden you had this outpouring of scary books that started coming out in the West. And, you know, we have The Population Bomb, Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher, Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. And all these books are basically saying that there are natural limits to growth on Earth and that there's a natural carrying capacity. And, you know, these are all outpourings of, you know, what's essentially transhumanism or, you know, things from 100 years ago with, you know, Blavatsky and stuff like that, where wanting man to harken back to being hunter-gatherers rather than having an industrial civilization. So that's going on in the West. And there start to be pressures, starting with David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger, where they start reaching out to Mao to discuss China's population problem. So the Rockefellers had, for a long time, since the early 1900s, they had been doing abortion stuff in China, you know, population control measures in China, often disguised as like, oh, we're empowering women and stuff like that. So the Rockefellers have been doing that. David Rockefeller visits Mao in 1973, and he wants to talk about opening up China's economy. And there's no transcript of that meeting. But, you know, you can see that the Rockefellers are interested in both opening up China as a market. And this is in the context of the Cold War, where the USSR is the mortal enemy of the United States and China is kind of off to the side. They're not really totally aligned with the USSR. So, you know, this is about undermining the USSR too. So they want to open up China as a market, and they also want to help solve China's population problem. Within 2 weeks of that meeting, China established the Family Planning Leadership Group, which is kind of the precursor of this one-child policy. Excuse me. So then right after Rockefeller came, Henry Kissinger puts out the very famous NSSM 200 report. And this is a report that basically says that food can be used as a weapon against the developing world. So as the developing world is expanding, they get access to more technology. Kissinger is saying, okay, well, the way to stop this is to hold food over these countries as a threat. Or we can call it, you know, if these countries play ball with the United States, we can make sure that they have enough food, and it's always going to be conditional, and they're always going to be beholden to the West. Or if they don't do that, like in the case of Cuba or something like that, we're going to blockade the countries, and we're going to make it very hard for them to maintain their own food resources, develop their own agricultural technology. And Kissinger also had been meeting with Mao, and it was very understood in those meetings. And if you look at the transcripts, Mao had a very clear understanding of what the West expected from China about their population problem. So this is in the early, the early 70s.
Wait. Yeah. Before you continue, what was China's population at the time?
I think it was around like 800 million or something like that. I'm not sure. I can check. 916 million in 1975. So then in 1974, China makes their last play to the United Nations Population Conference. They issue one final challenge to these Malthusian narratives, which are completely premised on, okay, you can only support X population with the food that you have. And they said, they made their last kind of defiant challenge to that. And then Mao dies shortly afterwards. And then Deng Xiaoping becomes the leader of China. And his number one goal is to reverse what he called backwardness in China. This is about, he wanted to open up the country, and he wanted to, raise the standard of living for the average Chinese person and ensure that there's a future there. So he begins meeting with the UN Fund for Population Activities, which is mainly funded by the United States. And he secures hundreds of millions of dollars in funding to come into China for reproductive planning and all this kind of stuff. And, so basically this is the quid pro quo of opening up the country. The United States, there's a massive movement in the West, the United States, to deindustrialize and to export all of our industries to the developing world. And China is positioned because they're playing ball with the population control freaks to be the recipient of that. They don't have an industrialized economy, but now it's happening because of that. So what happens then is that Deng becomes very interested in population control because he knows they need it to be the recipient of all this outsourcing, and he tells China's military defense community to stop researching weapons and to start researching science about, to benefit China, basically. And population control becomes a matter of national importance. And there is a missile scientist, and his name was Song Jian. And, this guy, all he did was study missiles. He wasn't a, anthropologist or anything like that. And he goes to a conference in Europe where they talk about the Club of Rome Limits to Growth report. He finds this report and he's like, oh my God, what's that?
Malthus.
Sorry. I thought I cut out. Yeah. So he learns about the Limits to Growth report, and this is amazing to him. He's like, wow, they found a scientific way to show why population control is needed. And he basically rips off the report. He goes back to China. He translates it into Mandarin. They disseminate it in all kinds of ways, through Chinese newspapers. And it just catches fire because there was a lack, a lack of sophistication in China about Western ideas. And I mean, they saw, if you think about the environment at the time, the Club of Rome, the World Economic Forum, all these things are launching in the 70s in the West. These are the cutting edge ideas. Every Western country that China wants to be like is talking about population control. And the unfortunate thing is that China didn't know that this was all posturing by the West. Like, the West kept growing, less than it should have, but the West kept growing. They didn't actually enact any of these things. These were just kind of, hippie theories and stuff like that. But China actually does it because they have, they had the will to do it because they were making a bargain with the West to be allowed to develop. So in 1980, they begin to officially adopt something called the one-child policy, where it's in Western accounts, it's often written about from an anti-communist way. So there's all these hysterical stories about, forced abortions and killing babies and stuff like that. I don't think it was really like that. If you read more nuanced accounts of it, it sounds more like it was encouraged that they only have one child. A lot of rural areas, it was unenforceable. A lot of rural families, they wanted to have multiple kids. They needed to have multiple kids to be able to work the farms and do what needed to be done out there. So in the rural areas, it wasn't really followed. But in cities, it was followed pretty closely. And it did lead to, it has led to a population crisis in China.
Well, I mean, what happened then? I mean, it clearly didn't work.
Well, yeah, I mean, work. It worked in the sense that China was, they made leaps and bounds with modernization because the West imposed these conditions on them to be allowed to be the world's factory. It was a horrible bargain. And it was a position, they hadn't, just, with Trump and Zelensky recently, where Trump's telling Zelensky, you don't have the cards. you don't have the cards. You don't have any right to tell us. It's the same, they didn't have the cards in the 70s. They would not have been able to be allowed to develop if they didn't do this, because it was, I think it was an impossible amount of pressure placed on them. So in that sense, it worked. But in terms of solving some kind of problem, the thing was the limits to growth, or the population bomb that was being warned about in the 70s, it completely did not materialize because humans are creative. And we come up with solutions to problems. We make new discoveries all the time. So the Green Revolution was happening at that very time, where agrotechnology was exploding, yields were increasing. We were able to grow food in places where we were never able to grow it before. So China didn't need to do this at all. I mean, they could have grown, if they adopted Western technology with their farming, which they did. They've been able to massively increase their yields and become an exporter of food in many, many regards. So they didn't need to do it. What happened in the 2010s, they started to really see, oh, actually, Mao was right. We people are precious. We do need more people, more minds, more creative people in our country. So in 2015, they adopted what was called a two-child policy, and now they're up to a three-child policy. And these are, once again, these are encouragements. They're not hard and fast rules where they're like Jordan Peterson posted a video of men being, it was like a fetish video where like men are being milked for their semen. Like, that's not happening in China. There's no coercion going on. It's really just they're encouraging people to have family values and to want to raise larger families. And that's all that's going on.
Okay, so let me just check to see if I'm following you correctly. So there was a population boom occurring in China. and the economy wasn't doing very well, but it was certainly accelerating, and this became a potential threat, particularly to the United States, who wanted to keep hold of that sort of grip on global power. And this was a way to potentially slow down any kind of economic prosperity from China. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. If they had continued to accelerate their population, it would have, I mean, they would have become a global power far sooner if they had if they were able to support a growing, vibrant population. The acceleration of their own sovereign technology would have accelerated. And I think something important to keep in mind here is how things have changed since the 70s, where, for example, genetically modified foods, GMOs, which people fearmonger about in the West. And it is true in the 70s that GMOs, you know, these were these new crops, new seeds that are able to have much bigger yields and help countries fix their food shortages. And the technology was held over developing countries because they couldn't, where else are they going to get it? They can't develop it themselves. So they became beholden to Western countries. What China did in the 2010s, now that they're free of this, they've busted through these limits that were imposed on them by Western countries. They actually bought one of the largest GMO companies. It's called Syntrga. It was like a $40 billion agritech GMO company in 2017 that they purchased from the West. And now it's their technology. And now they're developing GMOs and agritech to support their own growing population. And it's not so much that the technology is good or bad. It's that they own it, and they're increasing their own sovereignty by pursuing technology because they want to have a larger population and they want to take care of their people.
Okay, but just to be clear, the policy still had a negative effect on the Chinese population. We keep hearing about we now have older people and more males, for example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that there are slightly more males in China because they'd find out the gender of the baby, and then they'd decide to abort it or not because they wanted males for cultural preferences or for farming or something. But I mean, it really is a tiny, tiny discrepancy. And this is another thing. I did a follow-up to my One Child article mid last year. And I don't know if you remember this, but there was a big hysteria in the alternative media world last year. I think it was early last year about Chinese people coming through the border to the United States, and they sent Michael Yan and the Weinsteins and all these other people down to the Darien Gap in Panama and Colombia to observe the flow of these Chinese migrants. And whether it's Henry Kissinger or Michael Yan or the Weinsteins or Tucker Carlson also has said this, is they seem to believe that the one child policy was a breeding program to breed Chinese aggressive males who are these super soldiers who are eugenically bred to be able to migrate to the United States and form this fifth column, where their reward is going to be to rape and pillage through the United States. And this is just so it is true. Yeah, there is a tiny discrepancy with more males than females in China. It's very tiny, and that often gets used as an anti-China talking point to say that they were bred to be this way, and they're coming here to kill us all because they're very aggressive. It's just not true.
Is there any evidence of it though?
What's that?
Do they have any supporting evidence?
No, I mean, they go down to South America and they take videos of Chinese people building bridges and hospitals and roads, and they say, "Oh, these are the soldiers that are here to kill you," and they're literally there to help South America develop. So I don't think there's any evidence of that.
Are they aware that there are a lot of Chinese people building bridges and infrastructure here in Africa, like high-speed trains and all that. Is this part of that the superhuman military that the Chinese are sending our way?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is called the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a Chinese economic development plan, and it's an alternative to the Western paradigm of economic development. Trump is changing it. You know, under the Biden years, you know, the commitment that was always made to Africa from the West and from the World Bank and other economic development organizations was that we're going to force green technology on developing areas like Africa. That Africa will have to, you know, the West got to develop with fossil fuels and with nuclear, but Africa is going to have to bypass all that. We actually have to make it a lot harder for Africa. So Africa has to go from, you know, subsistence farming and subsistence living, and then they have to bypass this development stage where they go to a post-industrial stage off the jump. And we just force Africa to develop the hard way with solar panels and wind turbines and batteries instead of giving them the good stuff, which is fossil fuels, nuclear, developing their own sovereign technology even. So under Trump, you know, they have cut off a lot of the solar panel stuff, but China, you know, has always been, building relationships in Africa. Russia too. Russia is building a nuclear science academy in Africa to help develop the next generation of nuclear scientists. Russia has built 4 nuclear plants in Egypt, which are the first nuclear plants on the entire continent, other than one that's in South Africa that's ancient, an old, really old nuclear plant there. So, I mean, this development paradigm, to get back to your question, what these alternative media people say is, like, oh, the Belt and Road Initiative is a plot to get the world, dependent on China, and, you know, they're building all these scary ports because they're going to use them to move soldiers, the Trans-Siberian Railroad that China is building through Russia. You know, they're going to use that to move soldiers to Europe. And, you know, it's ridiculous. It's hysterical. And I mean, it's literally what Henry Kissinger would have wanted them to say. It's incredible.
It is ridiculous. I mean, this Chinese threat. Well, let me give you an example. South Africa, as you know, has got lots of mines, gold and platinum and diamonds, etc. One of our biggest mines is called Anglo-American, not Anglo-China.
Yep.
So who's the threat?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think this speaks to, when I pulled up, I showed these books from the 70s, and this is kind of an old paradigm that was an easily identifiable psyop or paradigm that was being imposed on the world, this post-industrial order, where the West has already developed, and that's in our past, we're going to be deindustrializing, and we're going to be extracting the raw resources from places like Africa and Asia, and then sending them to China. China will make our stuff, and then we get to enjoy the cheap consumer goods. China, you know, they can deal with the smog and all this other stuff, and everyone's happy with that. And that's what some people would call an entropic world order, an entropy, where there's a system, you know, systems thinking of seeing the world as a closed system, and that it just keeps rotating and rotating and repeating itself. And things like the Belt and Road Initiative and a lot of other initiatives that China and Russia are doing are these anti-entropic things. These are things where human beings are being valued for their creativity, and they're able to come up with new inventions, new discoveries that help us burst through these entropic systems and actually say, oh, actually we can support a much bigger population, and having more people is a source of excitement and optimism that, we're going to have more people to come up with even more ideas. And that's very different from what is dominated in the West, which is everything is doomsday. You know, like I'm in the United States. I live in a very liberal area of New York State. You know, Trump's in office and he's doing Republican stuff. you know, whatever. He's a Republican. There are some very promising things, like Chris Wright. Chris Wright is the energy director of the Department of Energy that Trump appointed. And what he's already saying about Africa is extremely encouraging. He's saying that Africa should be given full access to fossil fuels, and that the old paradigm of restricting development in Africa is so backwards. You know, Obama, when Obama was in office, he had that very, you know, terrible, infamous quote about if we gave everyone in Africa air conditioning and a car, the world would boil over. And Chris Wright, you know, this is Trump's guy, is saying that's not going to be the case anymore. We should help Africa develop their own resources. And if they're extracting stuff, they should be able to burn it too and use it for electricity and develop. So there are some promising things, but people in the West, they're so used to this pessimistic doomsday paradigm that they see what's going on and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe this. And sure, you know, maybe there's some things that are chaotic or unpredictable, but on the balance, you know, rejecting the old way, which is entropic and doom and gloom, and instead being excited that we could be in an expanding world with an expanding population, and people can actually be free to be creative and come up with new ideas.
Did you not say, though, in your one Substack article that the one-child policy handicapped population growth by about 400 million?
I don't know if I said, maybe I quoted someone saying that. That sounds accurate, though. It did reduce, you know, their population should be higher today if it wasn't for that stupid policy.
But it would actually be higher than India's. I think India now has the most.
Is that, I wouldn't know, but that's entirely possible. Yeah,
I heard via the grapevine. I'm not sure either if it's true. but funnily enough, India is not seen as a threat.
Yeah, India has been. There have been a lot of operations in India too to prevent them from developing technology. You know, one of them, which you know, my partner Fox Green, who I think you've interviewed on a previous thing. He's doing a documentary series about some figures like Vandana Shiva and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who have been deployed. You know, they're these intellectual leaders of this very anti-human, pessimistic, anti-technology movement, where they have done things directly to curtail the development of India. You know, in India, they're burning dung to... you know, to cook with, and they're burning biomass, which is basically garbage. They're burning biomass and coal to be able to run basic electrical appliances. And for the largest population on Earth, that's unacceptable. But all these operations have been done to destabilize India's, electrical adoption and their energy consumption, that have been very disastrous. And it's similar in, you know, you're in South Africa, right? I mean, it's similar there too, where these activists have, done all kinds of really dirty tricks that are criminal. Like I remember, I think there was an NGO, a Russian NGO called Eco Defense, which they were the big ones that were, trying to, you know, they're obviously a Western funded NGO. I think Russia banned them from the country, but they were the ones, you know, calling attention to Russia trying to build a nuclear plant in South Africa. You guys have constant blackouts. You really could use some nuclear energy. And they've been the ones, causing all these scandals and short circuiting deals in South Africa to actually fix the problems. And it's just causing causes chaos, it causes instability, and, you know, prevents these countries from developing.
And the funny thing about China is that it doesn't care about what the West says about climate change, and good on them. I mean, they're just building power stations everywhere. Here in South Africa, we have constant rolling blackouts. We have pretty much no new power stations being built, and we are completely beholden to the UN.
Yeah, I wrote, I think Fox and I wrote an article about this last year. And and the Western solution for all that has been to push solar panel development in South Africa, which is completely backwards. And these Western funded activists are there, and they're trying to stop nuclear from being built. It's a false solution. I've seen too that now floating power plants are being proposed as a solution in South Africa, which would be better than nothing. But you know, you should have been able to build nuclear plants 10 years ago when they were being proposed. And I'm sure there was corruption. I'm sure there was some corruption going on. But in the grand scheme of things, building a nuclear plant, you'd like to have that nuclear plant now. It would be done by now. It's a shame.
The one child policy lasted approximately 36 years, though, didn't it? I mean, it was ended around 2015, wasn't it?
Yeah. So around 35 years.
So why did they end it and say nothing about Kissinger?
I mean, they still honor Kissinger in the country. You know, until his last days, he took a victory tour in China and he was treated as a distinguished guest. And I think it's complicated. I mean, I think he was an evil man, and Machiavellian orchestrator of a lot of evil things. But I think in the grand scheme of things, Chinese officials knew that Kissinger valued their relationship, because ultimately working with China helped destabilize the USSR. So I think this is a Cold War thing where, you know, there was it's called the Sino-Soviet split. You know, China was not, especially once Stalin died, like China was not aligned with the USSR and they were off to the side. And the United States, it valued a relationship with China. This is why starting with Nixon, like they started doing these warming up of relationships. And so Kissinger, you know, even though he pushed, he gave them terms, but I guess he upheld his end of the bargain that they allowed China to develop, which clearly did happen. So they honored him at the end of his life. You know, it's complicated. You know, it's a very textured thing. And, sometimes dealing with the barbarian that you know is easier than someone that's unpredictable. So they knew where Kissinger was coming from, and I guess they valued the relationship.
I get the impression, Alex, that there is this weird self-censorship going on within Chinese governance. They don't comment on anything to correct it, whether it's the Uyghur genocide narrative, you know, the that whole thing, or whether it's that whole Tiananmen Square story. They don't correct anything. They just keep quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that what you said earlier about questioning official narratives. I mean, I think they do correct these things all the time. We're just not being told about it in the mainstream media. We're just being told who to hate at the right moment that's opportune. And a lot of these things don't get corrected. I mean, I think...
If you go into DeepSeek and you ask it about Taiwan, or you ask it about Tiananmen Square or the Uyghur genocide, it doesn't allow any type of discourse. Mm.
So you're saying that it's... I haven't tried that personally. So
you've tried it. Doing that? Yeah, I've tried it. And it just says it can't engage. And I'm trying to figure out why.
It won't say anything, or it'll say their official narrative?
No, it'll just not say anything. If you ask it about Tiananmen Square, it just simply says it cannot complete this request.
Well, I think initially it was. I saw screenshots of people doing that, and conservative people were saying, oh, look, see, this is Chinese subversion of, they're building a better, they stole our AI, and now they're doing this to to manage their reputation. I think China, you know, just like with Kissinger, China is doesn't want. I think the thing is like the image that people want us to have of them is that, you know, they're this bloodthirsty country, hell bent on global domination, aggressive. You know, they've been bred to be aggressive, but actually they don't want to rock the boat. And I think those topics, as much as it must burn some people inside that, you know, all these lies are being spread, they know that the truth is out there and that people like you and me are pursuing the truth. It is getting to people that are looking for it, and otherwise they're not engaging. You know, they're showing a lot of restraint. You know, they're being saints about it.
A friend of mine in China actually made a great comment. He said, look, the Chinese government is notoriously bad at branding.
I can see that. Yeah, absolutely. But in the grand scheme of things, like even with COVID stuff, you know, I know they had those very restrictive lockdowns, but once people started protesting, they lifted the lockdowns almost immediately. And you just imagine, you know, in the West, during that time, all kinds of protests were going on. And I don't think any, you know, on any side of different issues, I don't think the government's really being responsive to the people. In China, they were responsive. You know, the lockdowns got lifted almost immediately after protests started.
I got a message earlier from a friend of mine in the UK, and she says here, the vaccine schedule in the UK, she didn't think was as bad as in the US. But she says here, the baby is due to have 23 jabs before it's 16 weeks old. And that includes the two injections that it gets immediately after it's born. Now, why I'm telling you that is because a couple of friends of mine in China said that there is no mandatory vaccination of any kind in China, which automatically overturns this totalitarian hellhole narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of things that are these hot button cultural issues in the West, you know, whether it's vaccines, GMOs, pesticides, you know, censorship, credit scores, like the social credit score versus a, you know, you need a credit score in the West to be able to get a car or buy a house or to, you know, buy a chair on credit or something. All these issues. I think China, you know, what some people say, it's like might makes right, but in China, it's might in the service of right. So there's, you know, they have a lot of infrastructure. They have a lot of government, but they seem to be enabling people to make decisions for themselves and to be free within certain boundaries. But you can't just do anything. But it seems to be a pretty good balance there where people get to make a lot of decisions. They have access to a lot of information. When, you know, I go on Chinese social media, Chinese search engines, and it's through a translation. I can't read Mandarin. I don't know the native ironies and sarcasm, but just seeing the discussions that people have, I don't want to glorify it too much, but
yeah,
sometimes I see the discussions they have and I'm like, wow, these like just regular people in China seem to, the average quality of discourse that I'm seeing there about different issues on both sides is so much better than what I see on Western social media where, you know, they say on Twitter, like, or on X, they call it Elon slop, where, you know, the dumbest, lowest brow analysis of everything is presented. And then all you do is debate, like, oh, who's paying this person? This person's Mossad. No, this person is CIA. This person's Russian. You know, it's like the lowest common denominator. In China, there's like much more nuanced discussion of things, in my opinion, that from what I've seen. I can't claim to know everything, but they do seem to be, they have like a higher literacy for a lot of things.
Alex, I'm just interested in what is true about the world around us. You know, you spend your whole life being told that China's the enemy, China's the enemy. And so I'm determined to navigate through that fog of propaganda. And again, it's weird that you got to say this, but nobody, I think, is saying that China is some sort of utopia with rainbows and bunnies and unicorns, but it's just a country like any other with its pros and cons. If you want to move there, then one of the things you have to realize is you can't really criticize the government. They don't like that. Fine. Okay. But if you go to Europe, there are many things you also cannot speak about, you know, and, yeah. And so you have to choose your battles here, but you know, the one child policy, for example, seems to be then yet another one of these anti-China narratives that just doesn't want to die.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're imposed it on them. It's a Western idea, population control, Malthusianism. This is all Western BS that we imposed on them. And in my article, I go over a little bit. I don't go over it completely, but in the 80s, there was a big conservative backlash against the funding of China through the UN Population Fund. And this conservative backlash said, oh, we're, you know, what's going on in China is a tragedy. You know, this is part of the abortion debate. It's terrible that we're funding all these coercive measures in China. And what, you know, this is an example, you know, I complain about today about the false narratives and the lack of discourse. What was left out of that discussion in the 80s, that backlash, was that these policies, we imposed them on China. We made them do it. We gave them conditions for opening up the country. So to act like, oh, it's just specific to communism or to totalitarianism, it's simply not true. It's something that it's a Western in origin that we made them do.
That's the other thing I'm beginning to realize. This pigeonholing, it's just a result of the communist, that's the commie mindset. Like, this whole thing is also, these dichotomies don't really work. You can't pinhole or pigeonhole, should I say, an entire country into one word. The way Chinese people see their collective mindset is very different to the way Westerners view communism. It's a completely different cultural approach.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we, on our podcast, we interviewed Louis C.K., the comedian, a couple of years ago, and he had been to China. You know, he did a tour in China, and he was saying, it's like going to Ohio. You know, some of these, you know, it's a Columbus, Ohio. It's like a Midwestern American city that has fast food, and, you know, there's some pollution, and there's cars and taxis and big buildings and also rural areas nearby. And it's really not that different from a Western country in terms of these kind of markers. And like we were saying, there's a lot of ways where they have a lot of freedom. You know, small business is heavily, heavily encouraged in China, like small enterprises. You know, we do hear about these mega corporations in China, but also small businesses are the bedrock of their economy. These are people encouraged to be entrepreneurs in all kinds of different fields there. So, you know, the communist capitalist thing, you know, it's a distinction that doesn't matter that much. When you actually are looking for the truth and you start to see, actually, there are bigger truths here about entropy versus closed systems or, you know, believing in human beings. You know?
I was thinking earlier, one of the traps of the China one child policy conversation is that it ignores the fact that most of the world right now has a population growth decrease. I think most countries are below that two mark, which is, of course, replacement.
Yeah, I mean, the population is still increasing because people are living longer. And there's still a lot of gains to be had from people living longer. And I know what a lot of people say is, oh, well, if you're worried about population increase, just increase the standard of living, and then people will automatically have less kids. And that's kind of like the default view on it right now. The population is kind of stabilizing. The fears that people had are going to evaporate. But I do think that, you know, things go in phases, and it does seem like with this kind of emerging multipolar alignment, where countries are going to be a little more nationalist, developing more energy resources. You know, it looks like the West has committed to tripling the amount of nuclear energy by 2050. It just seems like the world is going to enter a new phase of growth. So I would say, as countries hit this this level where living standards have increased, people are living longer, the population will stabilize. But excuse me, I think I do think that another phase is going to start once people experience that for a while. I think I do predict that humanity will be looking to expand again.
You sound optimistic.
I mean, I'm not, it's not out of just being like inexperienced or, you know, naive. I think that if you look throughout human history, I mean, it's just like looking at the stock market over 100 years or something like that. It's just like human beings, like we face challenges. Sometimes the challenges last for decades or even a century or centuries. There are dark ages. But ultimately, I mean, what separates us from animals is our mind. You know, we're able to come up with new creative discoveries, sometimes in the face of incredible challenges. So I think our world is severely underpopulated, and we can support so many more people, so many more amazing people. And I just think, we are in somewhat of a dark age. I mean, if you look at Africa right now, the lack of development there is criminal. The denial of technology to Africa is criminal. Mm. And I think that continent in particular, if Africa is allowed to develop, and if countries around the world are actually going to help them develop, you know, the global population is going to increase quite a bit. So I just think it's realistic. I'm not optimistic. I think I'm just being realistic about, you know, what's going to happen eventually. I think the one child policy is one of the most misunderstood time capsules in history that has been used and abused by media, by politicians, to paint a false picture of what's one of the largest countries in the world, one of the most amazing civilizations. You know, I think anti-communism is a huge part of it. But what's even bigger than anti-communism is that the one-child policy is about a fundamental view of man, that man is a virus on the planet, and that our population has to be curtailed. And the premise of it is just, it's so much bigger than just anti-communism or even anti-China sentiments. I think if you look into the one-child policy, there's so many lessons there about modern Malthusianism and how these centuries-long fears about overpopulation have been applied to geopolitics and to just some of the biggest figures in history were all players in the one child policy. And there's just so many lessons to be learned there. It's hard to boil it down to one paragraph. I'm kind of blanking.
How can I follow your work, Alex?
So spacecommune.substack.com. That's the best way. And we're going to have a new part of a documentary coming out soon. That's going to focus on the real story about RFK Jr. and some of his forays into environmentalism and Malthusianism that have been very destructive for both the United States and for countries around the world. Also on X, follow us at Space Commune. Those are the best ways. We have everything that we do will be posted on those platforms.
Alex Dimitrios, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.